Hello, it is Thursday, April 25th. I'm Lodi Evola, and I'll be reading to you today from the front pages of the Hartford Courant and the New York Times. We'll begin, as we always do, with photographs from the front pages of both of those papers. On the New York Times, there's a segment of three colored photographs, and it goes with a story that we will have later in the program. The top photograph shows a bride and groom on a street, the bride holding a bouquet of lilies. She's dressed in white with sunglasses because they're outside, and the groom dressed in a black tux, also with sunglasses, giving her a kiss on the side of her head, and then four men walking by, seemingly oblivious to the bride and groom. They're on a city street. These take place in Kharkiv, Ukraine. All the photographs here do. The second photograph, the top one was about a 5x7. This is the next one is about a 3x3. A Russian strike took out a heat and power plant in Kharkiv, and this is a side view from the bottom side of that power plant. There's a man crawling over pipes. They are looking to repair the plant. And then another smaller photograph, again about a 3x3, outside a school building, and young men playing soccer on a field, and the caption under that one says that this is school number 134, and it was occupied by Russian special forces before the Ukrainians pushed them back. And then the last photograph on the New York Times shows about a 4x4 square picture. We will have that story also. It involves evolving bird flu affecting other mammals besides birds. And this photograph is, I can't tell if it's a man or a woman, kneeling on a long swath of sand beach. There's a small otter lying on its back, been injected so that it's actually asleep. Its little paws are on its belly. And this is a tester for bird flu, and the person is dressed in all white protective gear from head to toe. The only thing not covered are eyes. There's a baseball cap brim sticking out, and the person also has on blue gloves, and then there's injection equipment all along the ground. You see water in the background, but this looks like a desert. Anyway, that's the New York Times, and then the covers on the photographs on the cover of the Courant all have to do, or three of them have to do with Wicked, the production of Wicked that is coming to the Bushnell. The top one is crew members working on a giant speaker at the stage at the Bushnell, and then two smaller photographs, probably a 3x3. The next one shows workers. This is all backstage things. This one, the second photograph, they're preparing a monitor on the mezzanine. And then the last one shows workers getting Glinda, a character in the play, getting her bubble in place. And then the final photograph there shows President Joe Biden speaking in front of microphones, pointing with his fingers. And so with that, we'll get right to the stories. Justices divided over abortions in an emergency. This, of course, is from the New York Times. The Supreme Court appeared sharply divided on Wednesday over whether federal law should allow doctors to perform emergency abortions in states with near total bans on the procedure in a case that could determine access to abortion in emergency rooms across the country. The lively two-hour argument focused on a clash between Idaho, whose law limits access to abortion unless the life of the pregnant woman is in danger, and federal law. Questioning by the justices suggested a divide along ideological and possibly gender lines. What Idaho is doing is waiting for women to wait and deteriorate and suffer the lifelong health consequences with no possible upside for the fetus, said Solicitor General Elizabeth B. Perlogar, arguing on behalf of the federal government. It just stacks tragedy upon tragedy. Justice Elena Kagan interjected that the current situation seemed untenable. It can't be the right standard of care to force somebody onto a helicopter. Although the collision between the two laws affects only those women who face dire medical complications during pregnancy, a broad decision could have implications for more than a dozen states that have enacted near-total bans on abortion since the court overturned a constitutional right to abortion in Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization in June 2022. The dispute was the second time in less than a month that the Supreme Court has grappled with abortion. It is a potent reminder that even after Justice Samuel A. Alito Jr. vowed in 2022 that the issue would return to elected representatives, it continues to make its way back to the court. In late March, the justices considered the availability of the abortion pill mifepristone. The federal law at issue, the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act, or EMTALA, enacted by Congress in 1986, mandates that hospitals receiving federal funds provide patients with stabilizing care. Under Idaho's near-total ban on abortion, the procedure is illegal except in cases of incest, rape, some instances of non-viable pregnancies, or when it is, quote, necessary to prevent the death of the pregnant woman. Battered but unbreakable, Kharkiv carries on. The espresso machine was warming up, and Lilia Korneva was counting cash at the coffee shop in Kharkiv where she works when a powerful Russian bomb detonated nearby, sending up a deafening explosion and knocking her to the floor. "I can't describe in words how it felt. It was terrifying," said Ms. Korneva, 20. She was not hurt, though the courtyard where the bomb fell was destroyed, and a man riding a bicycle nearby was killed, according to city officials. Just a day later, the cafe was open again. Kharkiv, Ukraine's second-largest city, is open for business, too, despite a sustained bombing campaign that is among the most devastating of the entire war and growing fears that Russia might launch a renewed offensive aimed at taking the city. Russian attacks have destroyed all three major power stations, but residents continue to live and work with only a few, often unpredictable, hours of electricity each day. More than 100 schools have been damaged or destroyed, but classes go on, deep underground in subway stations. Dozens of fire and paramedic stations have been blown up, putting emergency workers in daily jeopardy, but failing to deter them from their jobs. When a rocket hits, within 3 to 4 hours, all the glass is cleaned up, all the central roads are cleared, said Andriy Dronov, the 39-year-old deputy chief of the Kharkiv Fire Department. By morning, it looks like nothing happened and there were no explosions. As the attacks intensify, though, there are real questions about how much longer Kharkiv, 25 miles from the Russian border, can hold on without more robust air defenses. Since March, Russia has been bombarding it for the first time with one of the deadliest weapons in its arsenal. Powerful guided bombs known as glide bombs dropped from warplanes that deliver hundreds of pounds of explosives in a single blast. It's a strategy to intimidate people, a strategy to make people leave their homes, to make people evacuate, Kharkiv's mayor Ihor Terekhov said during an interview conducted at a secret location since his office is a target. It's the destruction of the city itself. Since January, Ukrainian officials said more missiles have struck Kharkiv, currently home to 1.3 million people, than at any time since the first months of the war. Protests grow on campuses across the U.S. A wave of pro-Palestinian protests spread and intensified on Wednesday as students gathered on campuses around the country, in some cases facing off with the police in a widening showdown over campus speech and the war in Gaza. University administrators from Texas to California moved to clear protesters and prevent encampments from taking hold on their own campuses as they have at Columbia University, deploying police in tense new confrontations that already have led to dozens of arrests. At the same time, new protests continue to erupt in places like Pittsburgh and San Antonio. Students expressed solidarity with their fellow students at Columbia and with a pro-Palestinian movement that appeared to be galvanized by the confrontations on other campuses and the looming end of the academic year. Protesters on several campuses said their demands included divestment by their universities from companies connected to the Israeli military campaign in Gaza, disclosure of those and other investments, and a recognition of the continuing right to protest without punishment. The demonstrations spread overseas as well, with students on campuses in Cairo, Paris, and Sydney, Australia, gathering to voice support for Palestinians and opposition to the war. As new protests were emerging, House Speaker Mike Johnson visited the Columbia campus in New York, where university officials were seeking to negotiate with protest leaders to end the encampment of around 80 tents still pitched on a central campus lawn. Mr. Johnson said the school's president, Nimat Shafik, should resign if she could not immediately get the situation under control, calling her an inept leader, and that's in quotes, who had failed to guarantee the safety of Jewish students. The speaker said there could be an appropriate time for the National Guard to be called in, and that Congress should consider revoking federal funding if universities could not keep the protests under control. Republican lawmakers have accused university administrators of not doing enough to protect Jewish students on college campuses, seizing on an issue that has sharply divided Democrats. Some of the campus demonstrations that have taken place since the war began last year have included hate speech and expressions of support for Hamas, the armed group based in Gaza that led the deadly attacks on Israel on October 7th. Concern increases as evolving bird flu infects more mammals. In her 3 decades of working with elephant seals, Dr. Marcella Uhart had never seen anything like the scene on the beaches of Argentina's Valdez Peninsula last October. It was peak breeding season. The beach should have been teeming with harems of fertile females and enormous males battling one another for dominance. Instead, it was just carcass upon carcass upon carcass, recalled Dr. Uhart, who directs the Latin American Wildlife Health Program at the University of California, Davis. H5N1, one of the many viruses that cause bird flu, had already killed at least 24,000 South American sea lions along the continent's coasts in less than a year. Now it had come for elephant seals. Pups of all ages, from newborns to the fully weaned, lay dead or dying at the high tide line. Sick pups lay listless, foam oozing from their mouths and noses. Dr. Uhart called it, quote, an image from hell, end quote. In the weeks that followed, she and a colleague, protected head to toe with gloves, gowns, and masks, and periodically dousing themselves with bleach, carefully documented the devastation. Team members stood atop the nearby cliffs, assessing the toll with drones. What they found was staggering. The virus had killed an estimated 17,400 seal pups, more than 95% of the colony's young animals. The catastrophe was the latest in a bird flu epidemic that has whipped around the world since 2020, prompting authorities on multiple continents to kill poultry and other birds by the millions. In the United States alone, more than 90 million birds have been culled in a futile attempt to deter the virus. There has been no stopping H5N1. Avian flu viruses tend to be picky about their hosts, typically sticking to one kind of wild bird. But this one has rapidly infiltrated an astonishingly wide array of birds and animals, from squirrels and skunks to bottlenose dolphins, polar bears, and most recently, dairy cows. In my flu career, we have not seen a virus that expands its host range quite like this, said Troy Sutton, a virologist who studies avian and human influenza viruses at Penn State University. In case before justices, Trump can lose in ways that seem like wins. Most legal experts say that former President Donald J. Trump will face deep skepticism at the Supreme Court on Thursday when the justices will hear arguments on his claim that he is absolutely immune from prosecution on charges of plotting to subvert the 2020 election. Mr. Trump would prefer to win, of course, but there are, from his perspective, at least two attractive ways to lose. One involves the timing of the court's decision, which has received substantial attention given the relatively leisurely pace it has set for itself in the case. Even if Mr. Trump eventually and categorically loses, each passing week makes it more challenging for Jack Smith, the special counsel in the case, to complete the trial before the election. The other, which has received less consideration but is no less important, is the possibility that the court's ruling, even if issued promptly, will inject additional legal complications into the case that will take time to sort out. The indictment accuses Mr. Trump of an array of misconduct, including organizing fake slates of electors, pressuring state officials, the Justice Department, and Vice President Mike Pence to help alter the results of the election, and directing supporters to the Capitol on January 6, 2021. The Supreme Court is unlikely to embrace the broadest version of Mr. Trump's argument, that all of this was official conduct and cannot be the subject of a criminal prosecution. But the case is complicated enough that the justices may not issue a definitive ruling. That is what happened in 2020, when another case involving Mr. Trump reached the justices just months before a presidential election. The question was similar to the one the court will consider on Thursday, whether Mr. Trump was entitled to a form of absolute presidential immunity, allowing him to block prosecutors from obtaining his tax records. In July 2020, Mr. Trump lost the case, but the loss was a kind of victory. The court sent the case back to the lower courts for more analysis, running out the clock. In a concurring opinion, two of Mr. Trump's appointees, Justice Brett M. Kavanaugh, joined by Justice Neil M. Gorsuch, summarized the court's mixed message this way. The court today unanimously concludes that a president does not possess absolute immunity from a state criminal subpoena, but also unanimously agrees that this case should be remanded to the district court.